Hey, it's Bubba Wallace from 2311 Racing. You know what it feels like forever? Sitting on a plane waiting for takeoff. Good thing I've got Chumba Casino. With daily boosts and social casino games on tap, this is the kind of fun that makes time fly. Why not turbocharge your downtime? Play now at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Save big on your landscaping project now at Menards. We make it easy for you to enhance your outdoor living space with the largest in-stock selection of concrete landscape block ready to take home today. Build a fire pit or retaining wall with our tumbled Belgian wall blocks. On sale now. Save big on your landscaping project at Menards. Plus, check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now. Save big.
Ladies and gentlemen, the captain has turned on the fasten seatbelt sign. If you haven't already done so, please make sure the volume of this podcast is set perfectly to your listening enjoyment. Please take your seat, whether that's on the treadmill, car, sofa, or bed, and buckle in for the last trip. My name is Jamie Beebe, and I'll be your tour guide, recreating someone's last days in paradise. On behalf of myself and everyone behind the scenes, please enjoy the Last Trip podcast. And because nobody likes a long flight to get to where they want to be, let's prepare for takeoff. In October of 1995, 20-year-old Victoria Cafasso traveled to Tasmania on holiday, excited to explore one of Australia's most beautiful islands. She packed a towel, headed to the beach for a quiet afternoon, and never came home. She was attacked in broad daylight, stabbed 17 times on an open beach where dozens of people came and went that day. And somehow, no one saw anything. No one heard enough to stop it. No one has ever been held responsible. Nearly three decades later, Victoria's murder remains one of Tasmania's most chilling unsolved mysteries. Was she the victim of a random predator? Did someone on that beach know more than they ever admitted? Or has the truth been hiding in plain sight all along? To really understand why Victoria's murder sent such a shockwave through Tasmania, you have to understand the place where it happened, Beaumaris, Tasmania. Not a city like Sydney or Melbourne. It was, and still is, a tiny coastal community where, in many ways, the beach is the center of life. Even today, fewer than 300 people officially call Beaumaris home. In the mid-1990s, the permanent population was even smaller. This wasn't a town of busy intersections, shopping malls, or nightlife. It was a scattering of beach houses along the Tasman Highway, tucked between the Tasman Sea on one side and rolling forested hills on the other. The kind of place where everyone knows everyone else, where neighbors wave as they drive by, where you recognize the same cars parked outside the local store every morning, and where a stranger doesn't necessarily stand out, but they are noticed. There isn't much of a schedule. People wake up with the sun, check the surf, go fishing, walk their dogs, or spend the afternoon on the beach. Life is dictated more by the weather and the tides than by the clock. And in 1995, it was even quieter than it is today. Most of the homes along the waterfront weren't occupied year-round. Many were simply holiday shacks, family vacation houses passed down through generations, or small rentals where visitors escaped during the warmer months. It wasn't a luxury destination. It was an affordable, unpretentious slice of coastal Tasmania. Just a few minutes away was the slightly larger town of Scamander. If Beaumaris was the sleepy neighborhood, Scamander was where you'd stop for groceries, fuel, a meal, or chat with the locals. Even then, Scamander had a reputation as a classic Tasmanian holiday town. Wide white beaches, a river full of black bream, a surf life-saving club, and enough accommodation to welcome families making their way up the coast. And that's really what this stretch of coastline was all about, the beaches. The entire northeast coast of Tasmania has an almost wild beauty to it. Long ribbons of pale sand stretch for miles with remarkably little development. There are no rows of high-rise hotels casting shadows over the water. No boardwalk lined with souvenir shops. No amusement parks. Instead, there are windswept dunes, native bushland, rocky headlands, and the endless sound of the Tasman Sea. It's the kind of beach where you can walk for what feels like forever without seeing another person. Behind the sand are vegetated dunes that blend into the conservation land, while nearby creeks wind their way toward the ocean before occasionally breaking through the beach itself. Native shorebirds forage along the waterline, and during migration seasons, whales can sometimes be spotted offshore from Shelley's Point. That's one of the strange contradictions of this story. When we hear that Victoria was murdered on a beach, it's easy to picture somewhere crowded. Bright umbrellas, families shoulder to shoulder, a packed coastline where someone surely would have noticed. But Beaumaris wasn't that kind of beach. It was open, expansive. People were there that day, but they were spread out over an enormous stretch of coastline. One family might be fishing near the river mouth. Another person could be surfing several hundred meters away. Someone else might be walking their dog in the opposite direction. You could hear the ocean far more than you could hear other people. And if you've ever stood on a windy ocean beach, you know how quickly sound disappears. The waves become constant white noise, and voices don't carry. Someone only a few hundred yards away can be completely hidden behind dunes or a slight bend in the shoreline. So it begins to make more sense, though no less heartbreaking, how something terrible could happen without everyone immediately realizing it. People surf the breaks along this section of coastline. Anglers spent hours casting into the river or fishing straight from the beaches. Others packed a picnic, wandered through nearby nature reserves, or simply drove the coast looking for a quiet place to spend the afternoon. And that's why Victoria's murder changed Beaumaris forever. When something like this happens in a big city, people often assume it's just another tragedy among many. But in a community this small, it becomes part of the town's identity. Everyone remembers where they were when they heard the sirens. Everyone remembers the helicopters, the detectives, the television cameras that suddenly descended on a place that almost never made the news. It's hard to overstate how unsettling that must have felt. Imagine living somewhere because it's peaceful, feels safe, and you know your neighbors. And then waking up one morning to discover that your little beach town is making headlines around the world for the brutal murder of a young tourist. The ocean still rolls in exactly as it did in 1995. The gulls still circle overhead. The surf still breaks against Shelley's Point. If you visited without knowing the story, you might never suspect anything terrible had happened there. Which is exactly why no one could have imagined that one quiet Wednesday morning, it would become one of Tasmania's longest unsolved mysteries.
Looking for a little Hollywood-style fun? Check out Ryan Seacrest's 10K Ways exclusively at Chumba Casino. There's 10,000 ways to play. Get spinning for free at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See T's and C's. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Now, before we talk about the murder, the investigation, or the questions that have gone unanswered for more than 30 years, I want to spend some time talking about Victoria herself. Because when a person becomes associated with an unsolved crime, it's incredibly easy for everything else about them to disappear. Their name becomes a headline. Their face becomes a photograph used in news stories. Their entire life is reduced to the terrible thing that happened to them. But Victoria Cafasso was so much more than the young woman whose body was found on a beach in Tasmania. Her full name was Victoria Ann Elizabeth Cafasso, and she was born on June 8, 1975, in Surrey, England. Now, although she was born in Britain, Victoria grew up primarily in Italy and held dual British and Italian citizenship. At the time of her death, she was living with her parents and her younger sister, Alexandra, in Ospedaletti, a small seaside town on the Italian Riviera, close to the French border. It's a beautiful part of the world. Ospedaletti sits along the Ligurian coast, surrounded by the Mediterranean Sea, palm trees, and brightly colored buildings climbing into the hills. It was the kind of place where Victoria would have grown up, moving naturally between different languages, cultures, and countries. and that seems to have reflected on who she was. Victoria spoke fluent Italian, English, and French. At only 20 years old, she was already comfortable communicating across three languages, which tells you something about both her upbringing and her intelligence. She was not simply someone who wanted to see the world. In many ways, she had already been raised as a citizen of it. Her family was educated, accomplished, and politically connected. Her maternal grandfather had reportedly been involved in politics in Rome during the 1970s. Her father had worked as a criminal lawyer, while her mother, Zenia, owned a travel business in nearby San Remo. Travel, law, and public life were all part of the environment Victoria grew up around. You can imagine how those influences may have shaped her. Her father's legal career may have helped inspire her interest in studying law. And having a mother who worked in the travel industry may have made distant places feel slightly more accessible. Travel was not necessarily some abstract fantasy in Victoria's family. It was part of their world. And people who knew her described her as pleasant, gentle, and well-liked. She was reportedly soft-spoken, thoughtful, and intelligent. She was also described as strikingly attractive, with long blonde hair and a quiet presence that people remembered. Now, there does not appear to have been anything reckless or confrontational about Victoria. The picture that emerges is of a young woman who was polite, somewhat reserved, and still trying to decide what direction she wanted her adult life to take. And at 20, that's exactly what so many of us were doing. You're old enough to believe that your whole life is waiting for you, but young enough that you may not yet know what you want that life to look like. Now, Victoria had been preparing to study law at university. But before committing herself to years of classes and exams, she made the decision to pause. She wanted to take what we now call a gap year, a period of travel and reflection before beginning her formal legal studies. Of course, her father apparently did not approve. Considering his background as a lawyer, it's not difficult to imagine why. He may have wanted his daughter to begin her education, stay focused, and follow a more predictable path. He may have believed that postponing university was unnecessary, risky, or simply a distraction. And from a parent's perspective, particularly when your 20-year-old daughter wants to travel halfway around the world alone, that fear is understandable. But from Victoria's perspective, this may have felt like one of the only moments in her life when she could do it. Once university began, there would be courses, responsibilities, and the expectation that she would move steadily toward a career. She may have understood that this was her opportunity to step outside the life being planned for her and see something beyond it. So, despite her father's objections, Victoria decided to travel. In July of 1995, she went to England and stayed with her grandparents. She visited them regularly anyway, so England was familiar to her. It was not yet the enormous leap that Australia would eventually become. But it gave her a place to pause, consider her options, and begin making plans. And while she was there, she enrolled in a language course at Portsmouth University that was scheduled to begin in August of 1996. That detail is heartbreaking to think about now, because it shows that Victoria was not drifting without direction. She had plans. She had a course she intended to begin the following year. She was thinking about her education and her future. The travel was not an abandonment of those goals. It was something she wanted to experience before returning to them. And somewhere during her time in England, Victoria began seriously considering Australia. She had a cousin named Simon who lived in Tasmania. Victoria had only met Simon twice before, but they were a family. Just not especially close, and they hadn't grown up together. Still, having a relative there gave her a connection and a place to stay. Now, Tasmania must have seemed incredibly far away, but also just accessible enough to make the idea possible. So, she called Simon from England and asked about coming to visit him. The original plan appears to have been more than just a brief holiday. Some accounts suggest Victoria was considering staying for several months. Possibly as long as 6 months. This was going to be the largest journey she had ever taken alone. Now, I keep thinking about what that must have felt like for her. Today, we're used to having maps on our phones, instant messaging, video calls, and endless photographs of almost any destination before we arrive. But in 1995, traveling from England to Tasmania would have felt like truly going to the other side of the world. Victoria would have relied on phone calls, printed tickets, airport signs, and the knowledge that her cousin would be there when she arrived. There's something brave about that. Not careless, just brave. She was a young woman deciding that she wanted to see more of the world before settling into the future others expected of her. And although she was going against her father's wishes, she wasn't running away from her family. She remained connected to them. She stayed with her grandparents. She enrolled in a future course. She was just trying to balance independence with responsibility. Her journey took her from England through Hong Kong and Melbourne before the final flight into Tasmania. And she could not have known that only 5 days after arriving in Tasmania, her name would become forever attached to one of the island's most disturbing unsolved mysteries.
Bubba Wallace here from 2311 Racing. On the track, my car's look is everything. But today, I'm talking about more than just paint schemes. I'm talking about my favorite games at Chumba Casino. Check out exclusives like Stampede Fury and my own King Croc Fury. It's just as wild as my car looked in Texas. With over 200 games and new ones weekly, play for free at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
When Victoria Cafasso landed in Tasmania on the afternoon of October 6, 1995, she had no reason to think she had arrived anywhere but paradise. She landed just before 2 o'clock in the afternoon. And waiting for her at the airport was her cousin Simon, along with his friend Peter, who happened to be visiting from Sydney. It had been a long journey to get there, but this was exactly what Victoria had imagined. A chance to slow down, explore somewhere completely new, and spend time with family she rarely had the opportunity to see. The drive from the airport to Beaumaris takes you through rolling farmland before eventually giving way to the rugged coastline of Tasmania's northeast. Even today, it's one of those drives where the scenery gradually shifts until the ocean suddenly appears beside you. But before they even reached Simon's house, Peter had another idea, because the surf was up. So they made an unplanned stop at Shelley's Point, at the southern end of Beaumaris Beach. Now, such an ordinary detail, but I can't help but linger on it for a second. Imagine Victoria standing there after traveling halfway around the world. The salty air, the waves crashing below, looking out across this enormous stretch of coastline that was completely unfamiliar to her. And from the lookout at Shelley's Point, you can see much of the Beaumaris Beach stretching into the distance. It's beautiful, expansive, and peaceful. Now, while they were there, Victoria met several local residents, Hilda, Mark, and Mario. Now, Hilda and Victoria immediately seemed to click. By several accounts, the two women looked remarkably alike, and despite having just met, they quickly formed an easy friendship. It says something about Victoria that within hours of arriving in a foreign country, she was already making genuine connections with people she'd never met before. Now, over the next few days, life was wonderfully ordinary. She took short walks around the area on November 9th and again on November 10th, getting acquainted with the small coastal community. On one of those days, she stopped by Hilda's home, where the two women spent about a half hour talking. Now, it's impossible to know what they discussed. Maybe they compared life in Italy and Tasmania. Maybe they laughed about how much they resembled each other. Maybe they talked about travel or family or boys or what Victoria hoped to do during the months ahead. Those are the conversations that disappear forever when someone dies unexpectedly. Now, Victoria also attended a small birthday gathering on October 9th. It wasn't a big party full of strangers. It was an intimate celebration for Mandy Liu, the owner of Simon's residence. Now, other than that, Victoria spent most of her time quietly at Simon's cottage, settling into the slower rhythm of life in Beaumaris. Then came Wednesday, October 11th. It started like any other vacation morning. At about 8:10, Victoria told Simon she wanted to go for a walk to the beach. Before leaving, she asked if she could borrow a small shoulder bag. It was a simple request, one that probably didn't seem important at the time. And around 9 a.m., she left the cottage on foot. Simon watched her leave, expecting she'd return a few hours later. Instead, it would be the last time anyone who loved Victoria would ever see her alive. Now, what investigators have reconstructed over the years comes almost entirely from ordinary people who happened to be at the beach that morning. Individually, none of them witnessed anything remarkable. Together, though, their memories became the final known movements of Victoria's life. Based on 6 separate witness statements, investigators believe Victoria entered Boomeris Beach using the footpath opposite the Surfside Hotel along the Tasman Highway. Rather than staying near the entrance, she continued walking south along the sand for roughly 700 meters before choosing a quiet place to stop. Around 10 o'clock that morning, witnesses recalled seeing a young blonde woman sunbathing. And that was almost certainly Victoria, and she wasn't doing anything unusual. She simply found a spot in the sand, laid out her towel, and enjoyed the sunshine. It was exactly what thousands of travelers do every single day. Police later estimated that more than 50 people visited Boomeris Beach that day. People were fishing, walking along the shoreline, and swimming in the water. Families came and went. The beach wasn't deserted. It wasn't hidden away from the world. And somehow, during that ordinary late morning, something unimaginably violent happened. Now, based on forensic evidence and later medical findings, investigators believe Victoria was killed sometime between approximately 11:30 a.m. and 12:35 p.m. At approximately 1:30 that afternoon, Margaret McIntyre was walking her dog north along the Boomeris Beach near Freshwater Creek when she noticed something at the water's edge. Now, at first glance, it may not have even looked like a person. Victoria's body lay partly in the surf as the incoming tide gently washed over her. But Margaret immediately knew something was terribly wrong. She hurried to a nearby house and alerted 2 men. Together, the 3 returned to the beach where they confirmed it was indeed a human body. While one remained at the scene, Margaret and the other man left again to contact police. And the scene the police walked in on was devastating. Victoria was partially undressed, wearing only her bikini top. The beach itself told investigators there had been a fierce struggle. Scattered roughly 50 meters away were some of her belongings. The colorful shoulder bag, sunglasses, a bracelet, her ring, watch, and sand shoes. Other items had vanished completely. Her bikini bottoms were missing. Her towel was gone, and so was her t-shirt. Now, most significantly, the weapon used to kill her was nowhere to be found. Despite exhaustive searches, none of those items have ever been recovered. Later that afternoon, Simon stopped by the local post office. Someone mentioned that a young woman's body had been discovered, but his first thought wasn't Victoria. Instead, he wondered whether it might be Hilda Jackson, the local woman Victoria had befriended only 10 days earlier. Because Hilda was known to run along the beach. He asked about the woman's hair, the length and color, and that's when he had the awful realization. And that evening, Simon was asked to identify his cousin's body. 5 days earlier, he had welcomed her to Tasmania, and now he was saying goodbye. Back in Italy, the news shattered Victoria's family. Her parents had worried about her traveling so far from home. Now, the very trip they had feared had ended in unimaginable tragedy. And only 6 weeks after Victoria's murder, her father died. Friends and family have long said he never recovered from the loss of his daughter. And while no medical record can diagnose a broken heart, anyone who has lost someone they love understands why people describe it that way. And for the small community of Boomeris, the murder changed something fundamental. This had been the kind of place where people left doors unlocked, greeted strangers, and thought of the beach as a place of peace. Now, suddenly, that sense of safety was gone. Residents struggled to reconcile the extraordinary violence with the quiet community they thought they knew. The police responded with one of the largest investigations Tasmania had seen. The first major investigative team worked the case from October 1995 until March 1996, interviewing witnesses, processing evidence, and chasing every lead they could develop. When that effort failed to identify Victoria's killer, a second dedicated investigative team took over, continuing the work from March 1996 through March 1998. Years later, detectives would repeatedly revisit the evidence as forensic science improved. They would re-interview witnesses and conduct fresh searches. Even now, the case remains active. In 2005, Tasmania's state coroner published findings that laid out, in sobering detail, what the evidence revealed about Victoria's final moments. The attack had been extraordinarily violent. Forensic evidence indicated that at least two different weapons were likely used. Investigators concluded that Victoria was first assaulted with a blunt object. Those initial blows likely struck her arm and lower body. And during the struggle, three of her teeth were broken as she fought to defend herself. And then the assault escalated. She suffered 17 stab wounds to her face, head, back, and chest. The fatal injuries penetrated her heart, and the official cause of death was exsanguination, loss of blood from multiple stab wounds. The coroner concluded that Victoria had defended herself fiercely during the initial stages of the attack, before ultimately becoming overwhelmed. More than 30 years have passed since Victoria walked into Bumeras Beach, carrying nothing more than a towel, a small shoulder bag, and the excitement of exploring a new country. Her family never got to watch her become a lawyer. Her sister never got to grow old alongside her. The life Victoria had carefully planned, the university course, the travels, the future she was building one decision at a time, ended on a quiet stretch of sand in the middle of an ordinary Wednesday. And despite decades of investigation, advances in forensic science, and countless hours spent revisiting every known detail, no one has ever been arrested or brought to justice for Victoria Cafasso's murder.
Hey, it's Ryan Seacrest here, and if you're looking for some serious fun, head over to ChumbaCasino.com. At ChumbaCasino, you can play all your favorite social casino-style games for free anytime, anywhere. It's the most fun you can have on your phone or computer.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 21 plus.
When a murder is this violent, this public, and this seemingly inexplicable, people immediately begin looking for a reason. Who would do this? Why Victoria? And how could someone attack her on an open beach in broad daylight and then simply disappear without being seen? In Victoria's case, those questions produced decades of theories, rumors, and persons of interest. Some possibilities were grounded in witness statements. Others grew more from coincidences. One of the earliest theories was that the killing might somehow have been connected to organized crime in Italy. Victoria came from an educated and prominent family, and reports indicated that her grandfather had been involved in politics in Rome during the 1970s. The investigators explored whether there could have been some connection to the Italian mafia, but Interpol found no evidence supporting an organized crime link. And honestly, this theory has always felt extremely far-fetched to me. For it to work, someone would have needed to know that Victoria had independently decided to travel from England to Tasmania. They would have needed to follow her movements across several countries, wait until she reached a tiny coastal community, and then murder her on a public beach without leaving any clear message or explanation. And for what? Something her grandfather may have been involved with decades earlier? No, it's not impossible in the strictest sense. Very little can be declared impossible in an unsolved murder. But there has never been publicly disclosed evidence that Victoria herself was involved in anything criminal, political, or controversial. The mafia theory sounds dramatic, but drama is not evidence. As the investigation moved away from Italy and back toward Tasmania, police considered hundreds of people. According to later reports, investigators increasingly concentrated on three men: a fisherman, a doctor, and another local man. Tasmanian journalist and author Melanie Calvert would later describe the three central figures in her book, Tasmania's Bumeras Beach Mystery, What Happened to Nancy and Victoria, as the fisherman, the biker, and the doctor. Now, Melanie spent years examining Victoria's murder alongside the disappearance of another young European traveler, Nancy Grunwald. Nancy was the 26-year-old German tourist who vanished from Tasmania's east coast in 1993, 2 years before Victoria was killed. Now, on the surface, there are obvious similarities. Both were young women from Europe. Both were traveling in Tasmania. Both were alone in the Bemaris area when something happened to them. And neither case has ever been solved. That's enough to make almost anyone wonder whether the same person could have been responsible. But police have repeatedly expressed doubt that the cases are connected. Beyond geography and the fact that both women were young foreign travelers, the circumstances are very different. Nancy disappeared while traveling by bicycle, leaving no confirmed crime scene. Victoria was attacked on a beach after staying in the area for several days. The similarities are haunting, but they don't establish the presence of a serial killer. There was, however, another possible mistaken identity theory that police appear to have taken much more seriously. And that theory revolved around Victoria's new friend, Hilda. After Victoria met Hilda, people noticed that the two young women looked remarkably similar. They're both attractive, fair-haired women of a comparable age and appearance. Witness confusion would later reinforce just how easy it may have been to mistake one for the other. Now, unlike Victoria, who had only just arrived, Hilda was known around Bemaris. She regularly ran along the beach. And in the weeks before Victoria's murder, Hilda had a very chilling experience. During one of her usual runs, she noticed a man loitering on the beach. He was later identified as a fisherman who lived in a nearby community. According to Hilda, the man approached her, came uncomfortably close, and asked, "Can you tell me the quickest way off this beach?" That's not necessarily the words themselves that frightened her. It was the way he approached, the closeness, and that sense that something about the interaction was not right. So Hilda ended the run and hurried home. But the encounter did not end there. According to accounts of the investigation, Hilda went inside and showered. When she came back out, she discovered that the underwear she'd left outside was missing. Now, another young woman living nearby had also reported that underwear was stolen from a clothesline. Now, taken separately, these incidents might sound like disturbing but unrelated behavior. Taken together, and followed only weeks later by the murder of a woman who looked like Hilda, created a chilling possibility. What if Victoria had not been the intended target? What if someone watching the beach saw Victoria from a distance, mistook her for Hilda, and approached her believing she was someone else? The theory could explain why the attack seemed personal, even though Victoria had only been in Tasmania less than a week. Police treated the possibility seriously enough to use Hilda as part of a surveillance operation. For weeks, officers reportedly concealed themselves in the sand dunes while Hilda continued running her normal route. She carried a fishing knife strapped to her leg for protection while police watched for anyone following her or behaving suspiciously. But nothing happened. No one approached her, no obvious stalker appeared, and the beach remained quiet. In November of 1995, Hilda was taken to the pier at St. Helens, where she identified a man aboard a fishing vessel as the person she believed had approached her on the beach. That man became one of the most discussed persons of interest in the case. According to subsequent accounts, he denied being the fisherman who frightened Hilda. He was reportedly uncooperative during parts of the investigation process, and later attracted attention over an interim restraining order obtained by a teenage girl who alleged they had shown an inappropriate interest in her. Now, those details are unsettling, but unsettling behavior is not proof of murder. And the most important fact is that the coroner later said the fisherman had an alibi that effectively ruled him out. He was empathetic, saying that unless the man could somehow perform the impossible, he could not see how he could have committed the crime within the available time frame. Now, that does not necessarily answer the mistaken identity question. It only means that the particular fisherman investigated by police was not, in the coroner's view, Victoria's killer. But someone else could have mistaken Victoria for Hilda. Or the resemblance may have had nothing to do with the murder at all. And that's one of the most frustrating things about this case. Some of the most compelling details may ultimately be coincidence. Another man drew police attention because his accounts of his movements reportedly changed. He gave investigators two different versions of where he had been on the day Victoria died. He was described as having a violent temper, and he was said to have recently smashed through a plywood door at a woman's home. He also allegedly told a friend that he fit the profile of Victoria's killer and returned to the subject repeatedly. Again, none of that proves involvement. People give inconsistent statements for all kinds of reasons. Some people insert themselves into notorious cases because they enjoy the attention. Others behave strangely when questioned by police, particularly if they fear being accused of unrelated wrongdoing. But in an investigation with so little physical evidence and no direct eyewitness to the attack, inconsistencies become important. Investigators had to examine anyone whose movements could not be firmly established, particularly anyone with a history of violence or unusual behavior after the murder. Then there was the doctor. Of all the people publicly connected to Victoria's case, he would eventually attract the greatest amount of media attention. The doctor was Czech-trained and had lived and worked in Tasmania. Reports indicated that a witness may have seen him at a service station in the region on the day of the murder or shortly afterward. And according to those accounts, he had scratches on his face. When questioned, he reportedly said the scratches came from falling while intoxicated. He also told police he had been at home when Victoria was killed, but he did not appear to have an independent alibi confirming that account. A person having facial scratches near the time of a violent murder is obviously going to attract attention. But scratches are also common. They can come from falling, working outdoors, an argument, an animal, or dozens of other ordinary events. Suspicion is not the same as forensic evidence, and there has never been a publicly established physical link between the doctor and Victoria's crime scene. His subsequent history, however, ensured that suspicion followed him. He left Tasmania and worked at several hospitals in Australia and New Zealand. He faced repeated professional complaints involving alcohol, patient treatment, and surgical procedures. He had previously been jailed in Singapore for threatening his wife with a knife and failed to disclose that conviction when seeking medical employment. New Zealand authorities later suspended his registration following findings involving poorly performed sterilization operations. And an Australian medical tribunal found that he had engaged in unsatisfactory professional conduct and suffered from an impairment affecting his ability to practice medicine. To be clear, professional misconduct does not make someone a murderer. Alcohol abuse does not make someone a murderer. Being abusive or degrading toward patients does not prove involvement in Victoria's death. But when you combine that history with the reported scratches, the lack of a confirmed alibi, and allegations of knife-related violence toward a former partner, it becomes easier to understand why investigators and journalists continued looking at him. In 2008, Australia's 60 Minutes confronted the doctor on camera. The segment was dramatic. And honestly, it was constructed in a way that made viewers feel as though they were watching the police close in on an answer. Former partners and acquaintances made disturbing claims. Some said the doctor had suggested that he might have killed Victoria, but could not remember because of his drinking. Former wives questioned whether he could have been involved. One described being threatened with a knife. Others said he had a fascination with knives and kept a collection of them. The program also revisited allegations that he had behaved abusively toward women, including patients receiving gynecological or obstetric care. And it raised questions about whether he had once been investigated in connection with the death of a woman in Slovakia while he was a medical student. Those claims are serious, but they must be treated carefully. Statements made by former partners or acquaintances are not convictions. A person saying, maybe I did it and don't remember, if accurately reported, is disturbing, but not necessarily a confession. It could be manipulation, intoxicated rambling, dark humor, or an attempt to frighten someone. Without corroboration, it remains an allegation. And television is powerful. Music, editing, confrontational questioning, and the order in which testimony is presented can make a theory feel much more conclusive than the underlying evidence actually is. Watching that 60 Minutes report, I understand why so many people came away convinced the doctor must have been involved. But feeling convinced and proving guilt are two very different things. The doctor has consistently denied murdering Victoria. In 2009, Tasmanian police confirmed that he remained a person of interest and said they would review information relating to him. But being a person of interest is not the same as being a suspect police can charge. And no charge ever followed. Even more significantly, coroner Don Jones later publicly discounted the doctor as Victoria's killer. Jones acknowledged the doctor's serious professional and personal problems, but warned against treating those issues as evidence that he committed a murder. Now that leaves us with an uncomfortable divide. The doctor looks deeply suspicious in television reports. His history contains violence, alcohol abuse, and troubling behavior toward women. But the coroner who examined the evidence did not believe the case against him held up, and no publicly disclosed forensic evidence has ever placed him on Boomera's beach during the period Victoria was attacked. Meanwhile, police continue searching for someone else. They knocked on doors throughout the region. They interviewed residents and visitors. They gathered alibis. They searched the beach and surrounding areas. They issued repeated public appeals and studied whatever forensic evidence survived the poorly controlled crime scene. Yet for decades, no clear route off the beach and no definitive image of the killer emerged. Then, in 2023, investigators reviewing and digitizing the enormous case file found something that appeared to strengthen a much older lead. Witnesses had described a man running across the beach around the relevant time. He was believed to be in his 20s, approximately 6 feet tall, slim but athletic, deeply tanned, and extremely fit. Witnesses said he had the appearance of a surfer. Now, that description alone is broad, particularly in a coastal community. But investigators connected the running man more firmly to a distinctive light-colored Subaru station wagon seen near the beach. Police said an original witness had reported a Subaru driving erratically, tailgating another vehicle, and suddenly turning down a coastal track. That witness has since died, but had left investigators a map showing where the vehicle had gone. Police reconstructed images and video of the station wagon, hoping that someone who had lived in the area in 1995 might recognize it. Who owned the Subaru? Who was driving it? Was the running man fleeing from the beach? Was he late for something, exercising, or trying to reach the vehicle? Or was he simply another innocent person whose presence became suspicious only because of the time and place? Police have not publicly answered any of those questions. But the renewed focus on the Subaru suggests that investigators believe the man and the vehicle may be among the most important unresolved elements in the case. It's also worth remembering that the 2005 findings could not determine whether Victoria was attacked by one person or more than one, which opens another possibility. Perhaps investigators have struggled because they've been searching for a single killer when two people were involved. One person could have approached Victoria while another waited near a vehicle. One person could have attacked her while another helped remove evidence. Investigators think there were two separate weapons. But every theory in this case eventually runs into the same wall. There's enough to create suspicion, but never enough to prove it. And after more than 30 years, memories fade, witnesses die, and people who once remained silent become increasingly difficult to locate. In August of 2023, Tasmanian police confirmed that the reward for information leading to a conviction stood at $500,000. And in October of 2025, on the eve of the 30th anniversary of Victoria's death, police doubled that to $1 million, the largest reward ever offered in Tasmania. Police said they hoped that time may have changed someone's circumstances. Relationships end, loyalties disappear, fear weakens. Someone who protected another person in 1995 may no longer feel obligated to do so. Someone who heard a confession may finally be ready to repeat it. Someone may remember a friend returning home with wet clothes, blood on their belongings, or unexplained injuries. Someone may remember that light-colored Subaru. And that may be what this case ultimately comes down to. Not another dramatic theory. Not online detectives trying to solve the murder through photographs. Not a television confrontation. But one person finally deciding to tell police what they know. Whoever murdered Victoria entered that beach knowing she was alive, alone, and vulnerable. And they left knowing what they had done. And for more than 3 decades, they've allowed Victoria's family and an entire community to live with the mystery they created.
Ready to put a little spin on your day? Then check out Chumba Casino's new online social casino game, Ryan Seacrest's 10K Ways. It's free and packed with 10,000 ways to play, only at chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See T's and C's. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Whenever I cover a case like this, I find myself asking the same questions. What can we actually learn from it? Because I never want these conversations to become about blaming the victim. Victoria didn't do anything wrong. She wasn't breaking the law. She wasn't taking obvious risks. She wasn't partying with strangers. She went to the beach in the middle of the morning on a beautiful day in a quiet coastal town that people describe as safe. That's an important distinction. Some people hear stories like this and immediately start making lists of everything the victim should have done differently. But hindsight is perfect. None of us get to live our lives with the benefit of already knowing what's about to happen. The reality is that Tasmania remains one of the safest places I've ever researched. Violent crime is relatively uncommon, and the island has earned a reputation for friendly communities, spectacular wilderness, and some of the most beautiful coastlines in Australia. Millions of people visit every year and leave with nothing but incredible memories. Now that doesn't mean bad things never happen. It just means they're rare. And one of the lessons I take from Victoria's story isn't to stop traveling alone. It's to recognize that even in places that feel incredibly safe, it's worth building a few habits that quietly stack the odds in your favor. When I travel by myself, and I've done plenty of solo travel, I try to always make sure someone knows roughly where I'm headed and when I expect to be back. It doesn't have to be a detailed itinerary. Sometimes it's as simple as sending a text that says, I'm going to this beach for a couple hours. If you don't hear from me by 3, check in. It takes 10 seconds. Now, hopefully that message never matters. But if something goes wrong, a medical emergency, getting lost, twisted ankle, or even a car battery goes dead, then someone knows where to start looking. Australia is unlike anywhere else in the world. I know people tend to think the biggest danger might be sharks, but it isn't. Rip currents are responsible for more deaths than sharks, and many international visitors have never even seen one. Now, if you're unfamiliar with Australian beaches, swim only at beaches patrolled by lifeguards. Stay between the red and yellow flags. And if you're by yourself, think twice before swimming at an isolated beach. If no one is around, there's no one to call for help. There's another side to travel safety that doesn't get discussed as often, and that's trusting your instincts. One of the things that stood out to me while researching this case wasn't actually about Victoria. It was about Hilda. Now, weeks before Victoria arrived, Hilda had that encounter on the same beach, and it immediately made her uncomfortable. Nothing criminal happened in that moment. He simply asked a question. But something about the interaction, the way he approached her, how close he stood, the feeling she got, that made her run home. We've all had moments like that. Someone stands a little too close. Someone watches a little too long. Someone asks questions that feel harmless on paper, but unsettling in the moment. It's easy to talk ourselves out of those feelings because we don't want to be rude or seem paranoid. But if your instincts are telling you that something feels off, you don't owe anyone the benefit of the doubt. You can leave. You can change direction. You can walk into a cafe, a hotel lobby, or a busy store. You can call someone. You can make a scene if you need to. Embarrassment lasts a few minutes. Your safety matters so much more. Another thing I always recommend, especially for solo travelers, is trying not to advertise that you're alone. Now, that doesn't mean you should be afraid of meeting people. Some of the best experiences while traveling come from conversations with strangers. But it does mean being thoughtful about what information you share and with whom. Australia's Smart Traveler program advises solo travelers to stay in control of their transportation. Avoid announcing that they're traveling alone and research destinations before arriving. And finally, remember that safety isn't just about crime, especially in Tasmania. Weather changes incredibly quickly. Beaches that look calm can become dangerous. Hiking trails can turn remote in a matter of minutes. Tasmania police regularly remind visitors not to underestimate distances, conditions, or how quickly an enjoyable outing can become an emergency if you're unprepared. And I don't want Victoria's story to make anyone afraid to travel. If anything, I hope it encourages people to keep exploring. See the world. Take the trip. Travel solo if that's what you've always wanted to do. Just travel thoughtfully. Share your plans with someone. Listen to your instincts. Carry a charged phone and know where you're going. And remember that being prepared isn't the same thing as being afraid. Victoria's murder was extraordinary precisely because it was so unexpected. Now, for the overwhelming majority of people, travel remains one of the most rewarding things you'll ever do. So the goal isn't to let stories like Victoria's keep us home. It's to honor her memory by making sure we enjoy the world a little more carefully than we might have otherwise. More than 30 years after Victoria Cafasso walked into Bomeris Beach, her murder remains unsolved. At this point, the greatest hope for a breakthrough may be that someone, somewhere, knows more than they've ever admitted. Like I said, relationships change, loyalties fade, and information that once seemed impossible to share may finally feel safe to reveal. Tasmania Police is offering a $1 million Australian reward for information that leads to, or contributes to, a conviction in Victoria's murder. Police continue to believe that someone may hold the missing piece needed to finally give her family answers. And anyone with information relating to the murder of Victoria Cafasso is urged to contact Tasmanian Police at 131-444. You can also contact Crime Stoppers anonymously at 1-800-333-000 or submit information online at crimestopperstas.com.au. You do not have to provide your name or personal details. Victoria was only 20 years old. She had traveled to Tasmania searching for adventure, independence, and a chance to see more of the world before beginning the next chapter of her life. She deserves to be remembered for the life she lived, not only for the violence that ended it. And after all these years, her family still deserves the truth. And finally, remember to leave a review and rate this podcast 5 stars if you like the show, or hell, even if you don't. But either way, feel free to let me know what you think. Please follow The Last Trip on Instagram at The Last Trip Crime Pod and subscribe on Patreon to support the show. You'll get extra research, videos, photos, and updates, and even learn more about my personal travels. That's patreon.com/thelasttrippodcast. I'm Jamie Beebe, bringing you your last trip and signing off until the next one. Thanks for listening.
Bubba Wallace here from 2311 Racing. You know what's slower than a pace car? Waiting at the car wash. That's when I fire up Chumba Casino. It turns those slow minutes into fast fun. With new games every week, you'll never get bored. Next time you're stuck in the slow lane, speed up with Chumba. Play now at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.